Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, the website strangeplanet.ca. In June of 1972, five men broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at the Watergate complex in Washington, D.C., in a botched operation that would spark a chain of events that 2 years later would see Richard Nixon resign as the 37th President of the United States. The most famous source in journalistic history, Deep Throat, was the name given to a senior source that Woodward relied heavily on in steering him in the right direction when it came to investigating Watergate. The source was, in journalistic parlance, on deep background, which meant he could not even be quoted anonymously. This led to one of Bob Woodward's editors to label him after the famous porn film at the time, Deep Throat. Deep Throat was later unmasked as the FBI's number two man, Mark Felt. John O'Connor was Mark Felt's attorney, and he's next to discuss how the Washington Post betrayed his client, covered up the worst aspects of Watergate. His book, Postgate, paints a profoundly shocking tale of journalistic deceit. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. John O'Connor is an experienced trial lawyer practicing law in San Francisco. He's tried cases in state and federal court throughout the country. He served as an assistant U.S. attorney in Northern California, representing the United States in both criminal and civil cases. Among his interesting assignments has been representing W. Mark Felt regarding the revelation of his identity as Deep Throat. His new book is titled Postgate: How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. John O'Connor, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Hey, Richard, real good.
When did you piece together?
But I'm good.
Terrific. When did you piece together that Mark Felt was Deep Throat?
Well, I did that by fall of 1976. I'd spent a couple years just sort of noodling over it. By 1976, in the fall, I felt I could prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury. I was very happy that I pegged Mark Felt, and then I decided no one would care what I thought, and I went and got married, raised kids, went to private practice, and there I was. 25 years later, I'm sitting at my kitchen table with my daughter's friends from Stanford, and the fellow across the table from me mentions that his dad, his granddad, was Mark Felt in the FBI. It did my dad know him, who was an ex-FBI agent. And I, of course, fell off my chair and picked myself up and said, "Nick, you know your grandfather is Deep Throat." And that's, I went up and started talking to him, tried to convince him, first of all, to admit he was Deep Throat, and secondly, then to come out and let me tell his story because I felt he was a hero. So it's a very interesting story.
And how and when did you become his lawyer or his family's lawyer?
Well, it wasn't until April of 2002, and that's when I went up to first visit Mark went in to talk to him, and his daughter, who's was 60 years old at the time, introduced him as a family friend, and I sort of qualified myself with Mark. I told him I was a Justice Department guy, knew he was a Justice Department guy. My dad was an ex-FBI guy. I knew Bob Mueller, knew Bill Ruckelshaus. He trusted me, and then when I started talking about Deep Throat, I saw the knuckles on his chair go white, and he jutted out his jaw, and so forth. But as I began, Richard, telling him what a hero, and this is an old fellow that's got a bit of dementia, but he was sharp in the moment. He just can't remember things, but he's sharp in the moment. As I began describing Deep Throat being a hero because he kept our justice system incorruptible, it's like I saw his blue eyes melt. It was like I was letting him out of prison that he'd been in for the last 25 or so years as he's dancing in the searchlight for people trying to figure out who Deep Throat was. So I was now sort of letting him out of his prison. It took him a while before he would admit it. It was really, I sort of stirred up a hornet's nest. But in the end, we all think he probably lived a couple of years longer than he would have because he was now sort of a coherent, unified self, very much at ease after a while with his identity, and very much proud of what he did.
And so he finally publicly acknowledged, was it 2005?
Yes. As I said, I because he had dementia, I had trouble finding a publisher. So I would go around and tell, very much with confidentiality agreements all the way around, and I try to prove my case to publishers. Mainly it was my own circumstantial case from 1975 and 76. And I would convince them. They seemed to buy it. I gave them time before they bit. But then each one of them was afraid. They were afraid of circumstantial evidence, and they didn't think that my client could prove his own identity. And so it wasn't until finally I talked Vanity Fair into doing a magazine article in came out June 1, 2005. But it took a while to get a publisher, interestingly enough. They were afraid. They're all afraid. And Vanity Fair, because it was privately owned, people weren't worried about losing their jobs. I kept telling these publications, look, I'm the guy that's risking something. I'm going to have my name on this thing. If I'm willing to risk it, I'm confident it's him. So anyway, finally, Vanity Fair took a chance. Woodward would not help us. He would not confirm it. And as a matter of fact, he said a lot of things that, as I go through in the book, trying to talk the family into believing that he was not Deep Throat. And I go through that in my book. It's very intriguing.
And what was the, if there was one single piece of evidence that was able to prove or to demonstrate to Vanity Fair and others that your client, Mark Felt, was indeed Deep Throat, what was that piece of evidence?
Well, if I had to pick one, I'll give you two pieces, Richard. But this first one is probably the best one. Deep Throat met with Woodward in a trucker's bar on around March 5th, 1973, and let him know about the so-called Kissinger wiretaps. Very interesting thing where Henry Kissinger got upset because in 1969, someone leaked to the public that the Nixon administration was bombing Cambodia, the Viet Cong supply routes. It caused a very big uproar. And Henry Kissinger was purple with rage, called up the FBI, insisted that the FBI wiretap his own national security people, the people that were working for him, and then later insisted that they wiretap certain reporters, which the FBI did, although Hoover was a little reluctant to do it. Then it wasn't until, but they were so sensitive that they were not filed in the FBI's central repository for wiretaps, which itself is a very confidential place. But as it turns out, in my analysis, only eight people knew of those wiretaps. Mark Felt did not know they occurred until later when he became the number two man and they let him in on the secret. So when he tells Woodward in the bar on March 5th, 1973, the other candidates, you boil it down to eight right there. One of them's Hoover, he's dead. One of them's Nixon, he's not it. Kissinger, he's not it. So it gets down to two people, Alexander Haig, who was a general who was a chief of staff for Nixon for a while, and Mark Felt. And for various reasons, I knew it wasn't Alexander Haig. So that's just one. I mean, there's plenty of other things that I could prove it without that, but that's one where you say that's set in stone. Now, let me give you another example, Richard, and I hope this is interesting to you, and I don't rattle on too much. Stop me if I go too far. But there was in the book, in the movie, your listeners will recall, the Post admitted to one big bungle when they published that a treasurer for the Republican Party named Hugh Sloan had testified that H.R. Haldeman, the chief of staff of Nixon, was a signatory to the slush fund from which the burglars got the money. In fact, Haldeman was a signatory to the slush fund, but Hugh Sloan did not testify to that. He did not testify in the grand jury. When Woodward tried to confirm the story, he went to Deep Throat. Deep Throat would not confirm the story. They ran with it anyway, and an FBI agent had mistakenly mistook Haldeman for Ehrlichman, his Teutonic twin, also a Nixon advisor, and confirmed it, mixing up the two names. Well, what I knew was Woodward was asking Deep Throat for confirmation not as to whether Haldeman was a signatory, but whether Sloan had testified that he was a signatory. Nobody ever thinks of that in analyzing who Deep Throat is. He was asking Deep Throat for confirmation because he knew Deep Throat read the transcript. Only five or six people would have that transcript of a grand jury proceeding, which is absolutely confidential. There are so many grand jury proceedings out there, nobody ever sees them. The grand jurors see them, a few prosecutors see them, an FBI agent sees them. Well, I knew there. That's another tell that it had to be someone who had seen the transcript. And there may be, like I say, five or six people who had seen the transcript. So I could go through and bore the heck out of your listeners. But if you just pay attention, I felt as a prosecutor, when I prosecuted a case, I'd look at a document, and I might look at that one document for 2 hours. It tells you a lot if you just think about something deeply. And that's what I was doing. And everywhere I went, I said, this is Mark Felt. So I could go on. But that's the kind of thing I came up with.
Right. Was there any pushback from his family not wanting their father, who by this time was, as you say, suffering from dementia, not wanting to be subjected to the glare of publicity and so forth, in terms of him coming forward? Was there any pushback?
Well, yes and no. Originally, the whole family was very much in favor of it. But what sort of threw a monkey wrench into it, and I go through it in the book, is that I allowed the family to talk. I was the lawyer talking to Woodward. Woodward would not cooperate, but he wanted to talk to the family. And as I mentioned to you before, I go through in the book how Woodward tried to throw him off the scent. Well, that introduced doubts into some of the families. All of them. I'm not going to get in. I talk a little bit in the book. But that's what they were worried about. And Woodward had induced doubts that if this lawyer O'Connor, what's he doing? If he puts your dad out into the spotlight and it's not deep throat, and he's not deep throat, he's going to be humiliated. And he's an old man and he can't take it. And he's going to die of shame. And then they would call me up and say, John, are you sure, Dad? Because he couldn't remember anything. Mark couldn't remember whether he went to a garage or a tavern with Woodward. He just knew he was deep throat. But no one would believe him. They think, well, he's a suggestible old man. And I kept telling the family, please believe me. I've thought this out. Anytime you want, you just call me up and I'll go over the evidence with you. Please stay calm. And so they went along with me. And they had their doubts, I'll be very frank. And the daughter wanted to believe more than the son. The son was a very straight guy, good guy, who's really a and Joan was a lot like her father, very optimistic. And I go through that in the book. But it was a very interesting proceeding because of that.
And why would Woodward, Bob Woodward, try to throw smoke or a smokescreen? Why did he want to convince the family that Mark Felt was not Deep Throat? What difference would it make to him at this point?
Well, I'm a lawyer, and when I talked to Bob, the first thing I said was, won't it be great if you guys do a road show? People will love it, and we'll just split the profits, okay? With book, the movie, the lectures, we'll split the profits. Well, I don't think Bob liked that. I think he wanted 100% of the profits. He didn't want 50%. And wouldn't it be great? And he felt that since Mark, he knew enough about Mark's dementia that he thought that no one would buy whatever he said. And he felt that he could wait it out until Mark died. And then he would come out with his wonderful book and everybody go, ooh, you were so good. You protected him till the end. Well, I kept telling Bob, Mark wants to come out. He wants to come out, and if you have any doubt about it, I will go to a judge in private. I will get him a psychiatrist and a neurologist that examine him and say he's doing this of his own free will, because the fellow did have all his marbles. He just couldn't remember things. That's sort of a type of dementia. You talk to him in the moment, he was sharp as a tack, and he made decisions, and the family followed those decisions. And when he didn't want to come out, they didn't come out. When he said, okay, I'm ready to come out of Steep Throat, they followed that decision. He was a man who could make decisions, and I told Woodward that. But Woodward knew that he thought that Mark could not prove his identity. He was almost right. It took me 3 years to go find a publisher, and it almost – Mark almost hit the grave before I went and found someone. And that's what he was hoping for. And so I go through this in my book. That's one of the many right. betrayals of the Post that's held itself out to protect, to be the great protector of sources. And yet here I talk in my book, the Post was not a protector of sources at all. And I get into also how they didn't really protect them during Watergate. This is just one of 30 years of betrayals.
We'll get into to that as this program unfolds. But we have a couple minutes here before the break at the bottom of the hour. I just wanted to get into this aspect now, and we'll continue after the break as well. But you mentioned off the top that that one of the ways that you convinced Mark Felt to come forward was that you told him he was a hero. I just want you to spend some time explaining why Deep Throat Mark Felt was a hero.
He was a hero because the Justice Department, and especially the FBI, is supposed to be independent. We want the Justice Department and the FBI to call balls and strikes. Now, you and I can talk later about this Russian collusion stuff and everything else and how the FBI wasn't doing it. But Mark was very proud about the fact that the FBI was independent. And in its founding documents, Congress promised the FBI they'd be independent. Now, of course, you know, you can't always follow through on that promise if the attorney general and the president are over you. But the FBI had a very stubborn tradition of that. Now here they are in Watergate, and Mark Felt is being told to limit his investigation just to the seven burglars and not look at anybody else. So he thought he did not want the FBI to be part of a whitewash. He did not realize he was not out to impeach Nixon. He wanted a fair investigation. He actually liked Nixon's law and order and foreign policy. He was a Democrat, but he liked Nixon. He didn't like all the people in Nixon's staff, but all he wanted to do was investigate fairly and fully. And ironically enough, Richard, had the White House done that, history would have been changed. The FBI would have picked off a couple lieutenants, maybe a couple other guys, and that would have been the end of it. We wouldn't have had this cover-up stuff, you know, but that's not what happened. And so he was forced to go to the garage to get publicity so that the public would yell and scream about this investigation not being closed, and that's exactly what happened. It kept the investigation open, and then, of course, things exploded far beyond, I think, what Mark even thought they would explode to, because he did not know everything that the White House was hiding. So there is a lot to this, but he was definitely a man that was incorruptible.
What did he think of Hal Holbrook's portrayal of him in All the President's Men and the movie in general?
Well, I think he loved the portrayal. And he looks a lot like Hal Holbrook. He's actually probably a little better looking than Hal Holbrook he was in the old days. But what bothered him was that the Deep Throat character had been outed. Because remember, Richard, if you were to, for instance, dime the mafia, you would not want a book written about a deep talk show host who just dimed on the mafia. Your life wouldn't be worth much, would it? And
John, I gotta interrupt you. Pardon the interruption. We're going to take a quick time out here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. A newly published study says that the building blocks for life appear in stellar nurseries, areas in deep space where new stars are formed well before the stars actually form. The research notes that organic molecules, methanol and acetaldehyde have been found in these stellar nurseries hundreds of thousands of years before the stars actually form, according to a University of Arizona statement obtained by Fox News. This flies in the face of previous research, which says that protostars need to be present before complex organic molecules can be observed. And you can read more about this fascinating story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with Deep Throat lawyer John O'Connor when Coast to Coast AM continues. There you go. Just follow the money. And that is Hal Holbrook playing Deep Throat in All the President's Men. John O'Connor is with us, and his new book is Postgate. We were talking earlier about Hal Holbrook's performance, and you mentioned that Mark Felt, Deep Throat, enjoyed Holbrook's portrayal. But you said not so much the movie, and that All the President's Men actually sort of outed Mark Felt, and you were in the midst of explaining that when we broke. So you want to continue that?
Well, both the book and the movie, Richard, outed the character Deep Throat. And part of his deal with Woodward was that Woodward would not reveal to anybody ever at any time that he had a major source of this type. And yet, when he writes his book, I suppose to juice it up, the first 70 pages of All the President's Men are dry as dust. They're boring. And all of a sudden, on page 71, this Deep Throat character is introduced, and you get a jolt of excitement reading that book. And it was the most riveting thing about All the President's Men. It made the book, it made the movie, made Woodward a lot of money, fame, fortune, Washington Post, Pulitzer Prizes. But if you're the source, and you don't want anybody to know you were the source, because Mark thought it was just not right for an FBI guy to be meeting in a garage with an employee, with a reporter, that's not the, you know, that sort of violates the FBI code, because it seems like you're now no longer independent. The whole idea is he wanted to preserve the FBI's independence, and now it's going to look like, if anybody knew, it looks like he's not independent because he's talking to a reporter. And the reason he was talking to the reporter, as I explained, was a very good reason, and it was to keep the Bureau incorruptible. So the funny thing about that, whatever you want to call it, I'm searching for the right word, but in so doing, he would look like he's not being independent. So he was very upset that Woodward came out with that character. So in his own heart of hearts, he thought what he did was right. He liked Hal Holbrook, but at the same time, he would very strongly deny anytime anybody brought it up for 30 years until I saw him. He strongly denied to his family every time that he was Deep Throat. And his family did not think he was Deep Throat until I started questioning that day. And they saw him sort of light up, as it were, or I would say melt, when I started talking about the heroism of Deep Throat. That's when they first knew. So he was very much a divided character on that because of the FBI's image. Now, in that regard, he did not give Woodward ever permission to out Mark when he died. That's something that Woodward came up with. So one of the things I told Mark was, look, Mark, you better come out now while you're alive, because Woodward's already told everybody that he's going to out you when you're dead. Now, do you want to have me tell the story, your story, while you're alive, or do you want Woodward to tell it when you're dead? Well, how about that? And in other words, I did not know what their deal was, frankly. And I go through this in my book because Mark can't remember the deal. I didn't know if he had been paid by Woodward for the ability to portray him as Deep Throat. I did not know that. I just knew that he was, and a lot of this from Woodward's own book, that he was very upset when Woodward tried to get him to come out. So it was a very interesting situation, is all I will say. And he was very happy at the end of the day that he came out. He was able to enjoy this time with his family and get some public adulation for it.
One of the major premises of the book, Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. The Washington Post covered up Watergate. Explain.
Well, big time. As you and I have talked before, Watergate was a very interesting, exciting, sensational one-ring circus where we talked about the White House covering up, cover up, cover up, cover up. And that's what the Senate investigation focused on, was Woodward's reporting, the Post's reporting. Yet, as I note in my book, it was really a three-ring circus. And the Post withheld from its reading audience, it concealed, it suppressed many important facts, much evidence that the court of public opinion should have heard, so that the public could really see what happened here. It was a very much more interesting and intriguing tale than simply somebody stupidly eavesdropping on their electoral opponents, which was the story. That wasn't the story at all, and I explain it in my book. It made no sense. It never made sense at the time, and people have always come up with these silly reasons as to why Nixon would want to wiretap the Watergate. He didn't. He didn't know about it. John Mitchell didn't know that this was going on. Some lower-level guys did. But as I talk about in the book, this was basically a CIA operation. If the Post revealed what it knew about the CIA, sort of inveigling White House lieutenants into doing this stupid thing, they also would have outed the DNC, because what they were really listening to, and I go through in the book, they were listening to, shall we say, naughty talk between men and women, out-of-town men that were visiting the DNC, being referred down the street to the nice young ladies who like to go out with men with money. And that's what they were listening. The CIA had a long history of doing this. However, in other words, wiretapping important people who were in the throes of sex, both for extortion purposes and also for their mind control research. They've been doing it for years. They did it here in San Francisco starting in the 50s. They had an apartment right near an apartment I used to live in, where they would bring in prostitutes, and then somebody would watch through a two-way mirror. They'd record them. They might drug them. But unfortunately, everything the CIA did in the United States by way of an operation was illegal. And if anybody ever caught them doing it, somebody would have hell to pay. There'd be pensions lost. People might go to jail. And so the beauty about the White House was, the White House, if you could infiltrate the White House, as the CIA did through Howard Hunt, you can then start running CIA operations, and if anybody catches you, you can always say, hey, the president said I could do it. It's okay. If the president says you can do it in national security, you can do it, even though it's otherwise against the law. People have often misinterpreted what Richard Nixon said one time. They scoffed at it when Richard Nixon said, if the president does it, it's not illegal. That is true in matters of national security. That's what the FISA court is all about, national security. When Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, what he was doing was otherwise illegal because it violated the Fifth Amendment. He was getting rid of people's property, i.e. slaves. It's a terrible thing to say, but the courts in those days, the Dred Scott decision. So when Lincoln came into office, he said, I don't have power to free the slaves. It has to be passed by Congress, and we have to give just compensation to the slave owners. Now what happens is the South wages civil war, and then Lincoln says, aha, I have my excuse. I have a national security excuse. Now I can free the slaves. So he freed the slaves, but for the four slave states that were not part of the Confederacy and were not belligerent, he could not free the slaves in those four states. So the Emancipation Proclamation only applied to those as to which he had a national security reason to do it. George Washington put down the Whiskey Rebellion when the ink was barely dry on the Bill of Rights, and he went up and he, you know, opened up a can of whoop-ass on the whiskey rebels, didn't worry about warrants, didn't worry about anything like that, brought them back to be tried. But he didn't follow constitutional procedures there because it was national security. So anytime you're dealing with that, you know, Vietnam War was never a declared war. It was a national security incursion. So the president has very broad powers under our constitutional structure to order national security searches and seizures. And so the CIA was trying to gain cover by infiltrating the White House. They also infiltrated the Committee to Reelect the President through James McCord. And then they could say, if caught, it was a CIA operation approved by the president, national security. And that was the whole reason for them doing what they did. Now, the Post knew this, and it would have been a very much of an interesting civics lesson for the country, and we would have gotten all the evidence and said, you know, to a certain extent, Richard Nixon was and his White House was victimized by this, because it was not only Howard Hunt that had infiltrated the White House. There are probably a couple other people in there. I think this Alexander Butterfield was a defense intelligence guy.
Frank Sturgis.
And there was a spy ring going on. One of the fellows from the Navy was reading the burn bag, the papers in the burn bag of Henry Kissinger and passing them on to the Navy. There was very much an institutional clash in those days. For your listeners, in those days, there were very important national security operations going on. You had the Vietnam War, you had China, and you had Russia. And Nixon and Kissinger were nothing if not clever in how to play everybody off against one another. However, they did not allow the Defense Department into their schemes. They didn't allow the CIA in, and the State Department. Nixon was cutting out the State Department. Later on, Henry Kissinger became Secretary of State, but at the time, he was just National Security Advisor. So there are an awful lot of people who wanted to spy on the White House. The CIA wanted to spy, but it also wanted to use the tincture or the patina of presidential authority so that they could go do operations in the United States, and then later on, if they were caught 10 years later, they could tell Congress, oh, look, we had authorization. So that's what this is about. I'm not making it up because Howard Hunt was planning on defending himself at trial using a CIA defense. I talk about it in my book. And one of his witnesses was going to be his wife. One of the reasons he wanted to use a CIA defense at trial was because he could not stand the interruption of his domestic life, which was very good. He had four lovely children, a wife who was in the CIA, Dorothy Hunt, and he was very much in love with her, and he couldn't bear to take one for the team. The CIA would have just assumed Howard Hunt went to prison for a couple of years, kept his mouth shut, and not said anything about this being a CIA deal. That's what James McCord did. But Howard Hunt wanted to stay with his family. Well, he was planning this defense, Richard, in December of 1972. The arrest happened in June of 72. He was ready to go to trial in December of 72, planning his CIA defense. The trial was to start January of 73. Well, Dorothy Hunt got on an airplane to go to Chicago, and that plane crashed and died. And she died and carrying a fair amount of cash with her. And about a week after that crash happened, Alexander Butterfield, who I think was a defense intelligence plant, resigned his White House duties and became head of the FAA, which investigated the crash. Now, I'm not saying that the CIA caused this. There's been people speculating since 1972 as to whether the CIA caused it. But if they did not cause that crash, they were preternaturally lucky. Let's put it that way, because as soon as that happened, Howard Hunt lost a key witness, his wife, who could talk about this being a CIA operation, and the various protocols the CIA uses to falsely retire people and then insert them undercover places. That's number one. And number two, it also removed from him the motive to stay out of jail. As soon as she died, he made one last try to get James McCord to go along with the defense. McCord wouldn't do it. Hunt said, that's it. I'm just going to plead guilty and forget it. At least CIA will be nice to me. Won't yank my pension. I'll go to jail. So I go through this in my book, and it's a fascinating tale, but it's one that the public was deprived of. The Post knew that he was planning a CIA defense, they knew a lot of this, but they didn't publish it. Wouldn't you like to have known if you were reading the Post at the time? Wouldn't you want to know that the supervisor of the burglary team was planning to say, I did this because it was a CIA operation, in part?
Well, I wonder.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so we all remember those immortal words from Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, saying that this was a third-rate burglary. So it turns out he was right, in effect, that, you know, and that was sort of what the Post was focusing on, the break-in and then the cover-up, meanwhile ignoring this CIA operation and going on in the background.
Well, that's right. And one of the things the Post knew, and of course they just loved, no, they just always acted like they were just as puzzled as anybody else, but they weren't. Remember this, it never made any sense to try to get into the DNC in June of 72. First of all, the DNC never really is at the heart of the strategies of a presidential campaign. But if it were to gain information, it would be after the convention. At that point, there hadn't even been a convention or a nominee. The only person in the DNC that was a knowledgeable person, well, there were two of them probably, but the most knowledgeable was a guy named Larry O'Brien. And he was the director. He had previously been, or later was, became director of the NBA. The trophy they give out is the Larry O'Brien trophy for basketball fans. But Larry O'Brien was the head of the DNC at the time. And people have always speculated, they were going to listen to Larry O'Brien. And as a matter of fact, Gordon Liddy, who was sort of a dupe in the whole thing, thought that it was kind of odd. Why are they doing this? Why am I supposed to do this? Larry O'Brien's not even in town. Liddy knew that. Larry O'Brien had already decamped for the convention, which was going to come out in another month. He wasn't around. Why are he going in wiretapping? Nobody knows anything, and he's not there. The only guy that would know anything isn't there. So it made no sense. But the Post knew why, but they didn't tell its readers. So by the time, Richard, that this thing got hot, John Dean, a year later, John Dean pops up and says he's going to testify against Nixon. Now all the attention was directed to the cover-up, not the burglary. So for the next—
All right, John, I've got to take a time out here. We'll pick this up on the other side. And also I want to talk a little bit about Ben Bradlee and his connections with the CIA. John O'Connor, Deep Throat's lawyer, and the book is Postgate.